G'day and welcome to the Hunting Connection podcast. My name is Zach Williams and I am your host. Here we'll connect you with hunters, fishers and outdoor enthusiasts from around the globe. This podcast will share hunting and fishing stories, including past experiences, and tackle the tough hunting stereotypes our community faces. We hope to be a positive influence to those outside the community while also having a laugh along the way. Hope you enjoy the podcast. G'day and welcome to another episode of Hunting Connection Podcast. Today we have a very exciting guest. We got Khadija Assad from New South Wales. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Yeah, good. Thank you. I'm glad I didn't screw that up. Well, I don't think I did anyway.
Don't you worry.
I have to have a laugh with that because, yeah, when, like I was saying before the podcast started, when I did Ilias's episode, I stuffed up his last name about six times on record and just kept on stop starting.
No, you're doing fine.
Thank you. So You're from New South Wales. Whereabouts are you from?
So I'm from Camden of New South Wales, so southwest of Sydney.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful. And you grew up there then, I take it?
In that I did grow up in Western Sydney.
Yeah.
And, yeah, we had a family farm also in the southwest of Sydney, so around that vicinity where I live now. Yeah, so I know it really well.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful. So what do you do for work?
So I'm a communications and projects officer with SSAA New South Wales in the state office. And I still here and there do some conservation work with bush regeneration, but yeah, I'm full time at the office.
That's awesome. And how long have you been doing that for?
Roughly around 6 months. So working in the state office, but beforehand I was on the committee of Sydney branch, SSAA.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Very rewarding.
Yes, it is indeed.
That's great to hear. So how did you get into hunting and fishing?
So my father is a hunter and, you know, in the past time as well, like in generations, they were all hunters in Lebanon. But my dad in Australia, he was hunting birds. So he would go to Victoria and, you know, chase quails and ducks and all that with his shotguns. But he did do a few like with deer, I think, and goats as well. But, yeah, he was more of a bird hunter, but I took it upon myself when I had my kids. But beforehand, we would shoot like with air rifles on the farm. Even when I went to Lebanon on a holiday, I would shoot there a lot. but when my kids got a bit older and I was, let's say, a free woman, I took it upon myself to, you know, pursue hunting. And at that time, I had a partner as well. And he was very curious into hunting and he's never shot before. So it was a good experience for both of us. And then as years went by, I just kept continuing with it. And, yeah, it's part of my life, part of my blood, and I'll continue no matter what.
That's so good. Yeah, like wing shooting, bird shooting seems to be a very big part of the Lebanese community from what I understand.
Yes, it is. It's huge. So when you talk about like firearms, it's always about shotguns. Like it's a huge deal in the Lebanese community. So I've got two myself.
Yeah, awesome.
Because of my heritage, I'm like, this is like part of who I am, a shotgun.
So have you done?
I love shooting them. So,
have you done much
not?
Wing shooting?
Sorry?
Have you done much wing shooting?
No, not much. I wish I could. I really want to do my wit test. I haven't done that yet. But once I do, I am going to, you know, chase after birds and, you know, I do a lot of clay target shooting and I find that really enjoyable. And I used to watch my dad shoot birds and we used to run after the birds, collect them for him. And I know how to do it, but I haven't really gone out and done it yet. Only a bit, a few times.
That's the hard thing with duck season. It lines up so well with the rut. Like just that whole area when you're mainly focused on deer, that's when duck season is. So yeah, I'm yet to go out and go duck shooting yet either. It's on the cards eventually, but yeah, this time of year, deer's on my mind, and that's where it's at.
Same.
So you mentioned you started out shooting air rifles and shotguns and stuff. What was your first big game animal or medium game animal?
Yeah, so it was a goat.
Goat?
Yeah, goat. It was awesome. It was around the Mudgee area in New South Wales, and it was shocking and emotional all at the same time. But because I come from a family of hunters, I completely understood what the reasoning behind it was. And that was way before I got into conservation, so I did not understand that side yet.
Yeah.
So, as years went by, I educated myself. I got my certificate in conservation and did the baiting test as well. That course, you know, how to bait animals and poison them, which I completely disagree with. The reason why I did that is I just wanted to have some understanding as to why this happens. But what shocks me with that test, at the end, they recommend shooting.
Yeah, wow. Yeah.
After all that process, at the end, they recommend shooting. And in class, I was like, oh, I'm a shooter. And I do recommend that it is the best method and the most ethical manner and way to put an animal away, which is really important. Yeah. As we were talking before, goat was first. I had the experience also to, you know, skin it. And, you know, I was watching and I helped, and I started watching a lot of YouTube videos. And as I was also when I was younger, when family slaughtered sheep and goats, I would watch that as well. And the rest of the kids would run away inside, hide. And I was the only one that would sit there watching, fascinated, not in a bad way, in a good way. I loved always to learn, you know, anything, you know, that's different. Yeah.
No, that's awesome.
I just started pursuing, you know, larger animals, but my favorite is goat.
So how long ago did you take your first goat?
Oh, that was, I believe, 2014 or 15. Yeah,
so it's been a long time. Similar time you started popping up on social media as well in the hunting community, or?
Popped up 2017. Yeah, yeah.
I can't remember. It feels like a lifetime I've been following you and your adventures. But, I'm trying to pinpoint. I reckon you went to New Zealand, didn't you, at one point?
Yes,
yeah.
I did.
Sorry,
yeah.
What year was that?
Oh, dear. Oh, God. I think 2019, I believe. I'm not sure.
Yeah, beautiful. And how did that come about?
Okay, so there was this online competition, and I just, you know, on Instagram, you put your name on there, and I put my friend's name with me, and we won it.
That's awesome.
So her and I got to go. Her name's Ali. She's an amazing Greek Aussie chick, feisty. She's a hunter now. She's awesome. We got to go. It was all paid for except the flights. So we had to pay for the flights, but everything else was inclusive. And we got to experience something really amazing. And I consider New Zealand like home as well, because it's right close to Australia. And the timing with my history, like research, when deer were introduced into Australia, it was the same timing as New Zealand.
Yeah, very similar timing.
Same problem. Yeah, we have the exact same problem. Also with the bushland, everything that's been introduced there, we've got the same problem as well. So I consider that as home. And I love to stick to home with hunting.
So was that the north or the South Island you went to?
It was north.
North Island?
Very tropical. Yeah, very tropical.
Yeah, beautiful. Mm. That's where I've been. And, yeah, I'm off to the South Island in a couple of weeks' time. So I'm getting pumped up for that, going chasing tar and chamois. What did you chase in New Zealand?
Oh, we went after deer. It was mostly fallow. And my friend, she shot a spiker, a red deer. But I actually went and paid for an extra hunt on there, which was because I've always been fascinated with the Arawapu ram.
Yep.
I think that's how you spell it or say it. I was really fascinated, and I just wanted to experience it and taste it. And I did. That was hard. Like they're really tricky to hunt, really, really tricky. I thought it would be like another goat or some kind of, you know, sheep family. But they're the ghosts of the sheep family.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah.
And how did it taste?
Nice. In between goat and sheep. So it's not a huge difference, but really nice.
So I've had feral sheep here and I found it was beautiful. It was much more, I hate using the word, but gamier than farm-raised sheep, but it had marbling all through the meat and it was just beautiful. It was some of the best sheep I've had by far.
Wow, amazing.
So you have a bush block that you do quite a bit of hunting and conservation work on. How'd that come about?
So I had owned a unit and I renovated it, made sure that it was spick and span, sold it, had some savings as well, and I really wanted to own property outright without having, you know, repayments or mortgage, and I made sure that happened. I worked very hard for it, and straight away with my friend Elisa Roseman, I don't know if you... She was...
Badass bow hunter.
She was in Sydney or New South Wales towards the area where I bought. And we met up and took her with me. I just wanted her knowledge as well because she is a very smart woman and I really do appreciate her help so much. On that day we had a look. I'm like, because of my agricultural background, because of the farming with my family, I knew what soil is good and what would grow on it. And she knew with her heritage as well, with the her Aboriginal side, she knows a lot and she's a very smart woman. So it was a bonus to have her with me. So her and I kept talking and the agent was there from the real estate and he's like, you know, what's the go? I'm like, here's the deposit straight away because it was black soil. Black soil is gold soil on any property. And it was it felt like home straight away. Yeah.
So you've done a lot of bush regeneration on there and clearing, introduce invasive species. Has that been going?
It's going really well. Well, the sad part, I've got cattle on there. So they bring, you know, weeds from all over the place, even from birds. They come or they'll, you know, land on the cow's back, and they always carry seeds as well. So birds are a seed bank, which is a worry. So I've had a few aggressive weeds growing on my place, but I've been tackling it and I'm on top of it. And I'm lucky my property is a bit, it's got a few endangered species of Australian native, you know, grasses and trees in the area.
That's awesome.
So I'm working on that, making sure it's pristine. But as I said, it's not going to stop. There'll always be some weeds around, especially fireweed. This is a huge concern, you know, all over Australia because it's very toxic to cattle and sheep and everything that's an animal, you know, to humans, unfortunately.
Yeah, I'm not aware of it. Possibly if I'd seen it, I'd probably know, but yeah.
It's a yellow tiny flower. Yeah.
So what species of introduced species do you get coming through there? It seems like you get some game passing through from time to time.
Yes, I've seen heaps of fallow deer, red deer, lots of goats, lots of feral pigs everywhere. foxes, you see the odd rabbit here and there. I don't know how, but I've searched everywhere. There's no burrows. Nothing, so I think they're just saying hello and bye-bye. They come and go. But, yeah.
Definitely sounds like a game-rich environment. Yeah, it sounds like a game-rich environment, that's for sure.
Yeah. So, and it's unfenced, so they freely come and go.
So what type of gear do you run when you go out for a hunt? So do you mainly just do a day hunt, morning hunt, afternoon hunt? What's your go-to and what type of gear do you take?
Majority of the time I like going in the morning. You know, it's nice and cool. They're still out feeding, you know, before the sun rises completely. And then in the afternoon as well, it's cooling down again and they come out to cool down. And, you know, that's mostly in spring and autumn. That's what I do. But in winter, I always say in winter, they're out here and there, not all the time, but they do come out more than when it's a warmer day. But yeah, it's a lot of mixtures. But most of the times I go on day trips and sometimes I do overnights. But when I'm on my property, I'm there for like 3 or 4 days, you know, if I have a chance. But in summer, I don't step a foot on there.
Yeah. So
yeah.
What are you taking out with you for a day hunt?
Yeah, just a very light backpack with a first aid kit and some snake bandages as well, some water. I take a torch just in case because you don't know what happens. Extra, I add a few snacks that I won't eat, but that's for an emergency. A little packet of wipes and my binoculars and my rifle and a knife.
What type of snacks are you taking out with you?
Sorry,
snacks? What type of snacks?
So like a muesli bar, anything that's rich, you know, that would give you energy, you know, some mixed nuts.
Yep.
So anything that's rich in oils and a lot of carbs that's in there, that because we burn energy a lot out there, so we need some carbs. Yeah, 100%. So people who say we don't need carbs, you're not right. You're wrong. We need it.
What about your rifle? What type of rifle are you hunting with? What caliber?
So my favorite caliber, which is always on me, is a 243. But when I'm out hunting big game, I either take my 30-06 or back in the days when I had my 308 as well.
Yeah, beautiful. And what about binos? What type of binos are you running?
Oh, God. It's Meopta, but I forgot the... Yeah, I can't remember.
Yeah, no worries. So what would be your top beginner tip for someone getting into hunting?
Yep, so if you're really interested in becoming a hunter, don't go out there with a gun yet. Go study the land, study the trees, where everything is located, look for signs, look for droppings, study the droppings. You know, you start learning the movements of animals and go to the range, whether it's, you know, shooting with a firearm or shooting with a bow. Perfect your aim. Make sure your aim is, you know, precise to the closest of the target where you're aiming before you head out. You know, have that confidence. Do not go out there with a firearm or a bow without making sure you know you're confident enough that you're going to do a ethical shot.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, but if you're starting off with a rifle, practice with a 22, you know, because it doesn't have, it barely has any recoil, and you're going to aim, you know, and shoot perfectly with a 22 before you start shooting with a bigger caliber. But do, you know, try other calibers while you're still learning so you can get used to, you know, the feeling of it and what is the most comfortable for your own body. Yeah.
So what about women getting into the sport? Because it's a fairly male-dominated space.
Yep.
What do you recommend there? Because I've had Lana on the podcast. She's a mutual friend of ours. Yep. She's getting out with you, learning how to shoot, and hopefully getting out for a hunt soon.
Oh, that's already organised.
That's so good to hear. I can't wait to see and hear all already about that.
Yeah, I always recommend women, you know, don't be afraid. You know, if you need help or you're curious about the sport, ask, you know, ask questions. If you don't know anyone at all, seek, you know, a club or do your research. Google is an open book, you know. It's got every information out there. It teaches you, you know, like with Google, I think we're very lucky because we've got an encyclopedia of the world on there. So you've got all the information about shooting. If you're worried about, you know, the effects of, oh, my God, that's going to hurt me or anything, it's not going to hurt you. But, yeah, look for try shooting programs. Look for, you know, calendar, you know, updates on, you know, clubs and whatnot. They always welcome try shooters. And if you're feeling nervous, you know, going in as a woman and seeing all the men, because I felt the same, it was very intimidating. I'm not afraid of men whatsoever, but it's just that feeling of, oh God, I'm going to be embarrassed. I'm not going to do the right thing. You know, people are going to look at me, you know, that whole, not fear, but that worry of, you know, I'm going to be laughed at. And a lot of women feel the same. They don't admit it, but they do feel the same after I've spoken to a lot. So hence why I created this latest shooting program. It's a way to introduce women to the shooting sport, make new friends, you know, people who relate to what you're interested in, you know, mingle, have a snack here and there, go for a shoot. And the women who are interested in hunting, I try to take them under my wings and try to, you know, help them out. And most of them don't like being online about it. So I've helped a lot of women, but I've never posted about it for their own privacies because they don't want to, which is understandable. It's that intimidation, that fear.
Yeah, 100%. How did that program come about and what went into setting up a program like that?
Yep. So what happened is I joined SSAA Sydney branch on the committee, and they were very interested in how I became, you know, a hunter and what was the reasoning behind it and what my goals in the future are. And my goals, my answer was, I want to see more women in the sport. And it's so sad not to see that many women out there, especially every time I went to the range, because I used to go weekly. It was an obsession with me. And they were really interested in what I brought on the table, you know, and they helped me, you know, create that program, implement every idea I had on there and make it happen. And it did. And I am so blessed to have a lot of supporters who sponsor my program and are able to gift the women with, you know, a lot of fun items to use for the future. You know, it's just a nice atmosphere. They don't feel any intimidation. They become friends with range officers as well, who are male figures in the sport. I've had a lot of women become licensed shooters.
No, that's so good to hear. And how long has that been running for?
So since 2018. Yeah.
That's right. And how often do you run these seminars?
Yep. So every quarter of the year, I run the SSAA Sydney Ladies Shooting Program. But I'm working on new projects where hopefully every month something will happen as a tri shooting program, all inclusive, men, women, and kids.
That's so great to hear.
Yeah.
What would be your advice to make things more friendly for women coming into the sport and the lifestyle?
My advice, I would say, don't be afraid. It's not scary at all. A firearm is a tool. It's not going to hurt you whatsoever in any way. It's you who is in control. So if you want to pull the trigger, you're the one who's going to pull the trigger. It's going to shoot. If you don't want it to shoot, you're the one who's in control. Talk to people, you know, seek, you know, advice from people who have been in the sport before. You know, and if you do have family members, ask them, can I go with you? Can I, you know, see and watch? I won't shoot, but I want to watch. I want to learn. You know, there's a lot of ways you can, you know, involve yourself in this sport.
What about clubs and ranges? Because often they're considered a boys' club, quote unquote. How can clubs and ranges and all of those types of things become more women friendly and inviting?
Yep. So what I've done, and I hope a lot of others do that, I've created tri shooting vests that are coloured in pink. And then we've got the blue ones and all the other colours for the boys. But I've tried to implement, like, you know, femininity into the ranges, and I've been sending out those ideas to other branches and other clubs and all the affiliate clubs, not necessarily only SSAA, so all the other clubs as well, be sending ideas out there, what they can do, and you know, try to organize. Like, what I do is I always choose a charity that's closest to a mother in a way. So like for autism, anything to do with children, anything to do with cancer, also with mental health issues for men and women, I've done that as well. You know, bringing things like that into the range, it makes a woman feel like this is home, this is safe, this is, you know, all inclusive. I'm going to do good out of it. It's not just shooting. There's something good behind it. Yeah.
So when you bring those charities in, how are you bringing those charities in, getting them involved? Yep. Are you fundraising for them on the range days? Yeah.
Every try shoot program I have, it's a fundraiser. We don't pocket not even a cent towards the club. Nothing goes towards the club. All goes to charity. I also often invite the actual people who run the charity. They come for a shoot who have never shot before. And I know a few that have now become licensed shooters.
That's awesome.
Which is amazing. Yeah.
Has it taken when you approach these charities as a shooting organisation? Has it often taken? Do you find that it gets rejected because shooters and shooting and firearms have such a negative light in the media?
No, not at all, which is surprising. I've had a lot of positive outcomes from it. The curiosity from them and to understand what is happening with media and how where we are as a shooter, because they've never ever thought that there is a law-abiding firearms, you know, owner out there. It's all about, you know, the bad stuff that you see on media, which is involved with gangs and, unfortunately, and it portrays us law-abiding citizens as the bad people in front of, you know, the normal peeps out there. But yeah, their curiosity gets them involved in the sport and want to be part of that fundraiser, and they start advertising on our behalf as well that this try shooting program is going to fundraise for us. And from there, and we get people also interested to come and try shoot, which is amazing.
That's awesome to hear, because I've heard from, you know, hunters clubs in the past that have done charity fundraising type stuff that they often get rejected when approaching some organisations because of that whole negative firearms media stuff, you know. So it's great that these people were coming in with an open mind, and some of them have gone out and got their licenses afterwards. So you do a bit of freaking everything. Like you're like you've done acting stuff in the past. When you meet people in that type of industry, how do you find when you're having that chat, what do you get up to on the weekend? And you start telling them that you go out hunting and shooting. How does that go down?
I'm very open and very proud about it. And I've had a few actors that have become hunters.
That's so good to hear.
Have acted with me, which is amazing. I often start off with like, oh, I'm going hiking. Oh, yeah, where to? Oh, this particular state forest. Oh, okay. What do you look for? Like, because a lot of people go looking for, you know, specific flowers or some kind of something, mushrooms, or you know how it is.
Yeah.
I'm looking for four-legged animals. Oh, what do you mean? I hold a rifle on my back and I go for a hike. But I start off, you know, like making it really sound really simple, really therapeutic. You know, it's not about the shooting. I tell them that I go out there, I clear my mind, you know, nourish my soul. It's not all about shooting, you know, at the end of the day. You know, I'm out there just to recover from work, recover from what I've been through, you know, during the week. And they find it fascinating. It's amazing. It's really good. I've never had anything negative. I've had actors that were vegan as well, that were really, really fascinated and interested as, like, for me coming into this as a conservationist, and most of them are, you know, non-meat eaters, you know. I had a lot of colleagues that were non-meat eaters, and it was a bit hard at first, but once they become understand who I am and why I do it, and like, for example, when we're creating habitats for our native wildlife, because we did that a lot. And I'm like, see, you're doing something that is very similar to what I do. You're like, what? I'm like, you're protecting our native wildlife. And this is what I'm doing with my hunting. It's conservation work, making sure our native wildlife is protected, and I get to eat it. I get to eat what I should. So it's a bonus on all ends. And I'm not out there like a trigger happy, crazy person, which we rarely have that, thank goodness. But I actually put so much thought into it. That's when I'm having a conversation with them, trying to make them understand. Put so much thought into it. A lot of care. I care about the animal that I'm about to shoot. I'm not out there not caring. So as ethically as possible, I drop the animal. And if I'm not confident that the animal's, you know, not going to drop, I won't shoot, even if it's in front of me. Yeah. And that's my ethics behind it. And they respect that.
That's awesome to hear. My cousin's just gone through one of the top acting schools over that way. And, you know, it's the stories that I get told, it's very political, very woke, very, yeah. So he's, you know, he's been too scared to say, you know, I've gone out with my cousin and all of that type of stuff, just because of the criticism and, you know, that people don't get jobs for certain stuff just because of stuff that they've done in the past, you know, and hunting could be one of those things. So it's great that you're getting out there and you're putting hunting on out there on in such a positive light. So
absolutely.
So
thank you.
No, that's all good. Top five items for a beginner getting into hunting and shooting, what would you recommend?
Okay, so a 22 caliber rifle or a low poundage bow. So I shoot archery, but I don't hunt with a bow though. Maybe later on in the future once I am confident. But yeah, so a light caliber rifle, start off, if you do end up hunting, you start off with rabbits, you know, small prey, a bino, so binoculars, something not too expensive because you will drop it a couple of times while you're still fresh at it, because so you can damage your tools. A nice lightweight backpack, because surely you're not going to hunt something straight away that's big, and with a 22 caliber, that's not recommended. Also a first aid kit. Make sure you've got a first aid kit and a knife. These are the five items I recommend. You know, you need to make sure you're protected and got the right gear, and lightweight clothing with a nice warm jacket that you can pack in your backpack when you get too cold. You wear that and that's it. And good shoes. So does it have to be hiking shoes? I kid you not, I wear work boots, steel caps. I find them the safest because on my property I have a lot of snakes. So with my gaiters and then the steel cap, I'm completely protected. And they've got ankle protection as well, which is good. Support, yeah.
So knives, what type of knife do you recommend there? Are you recommending something foldable, something fixed blade, replaceable blade? What are you running?
So if you are going to go out and hunt something that's like small to medium, I would get a fixed blade with a hook on the end, you know, the gutting hook. That was what I had as my first knife, because you need to learn the method of gutting an animal. So if you're going to do it straight with a normal knife, you're going to hate your life with the smell. If you bust the stomach up, it's not good. So I would recommend a hook on a knife that, you know, straight away you just put it in there and slide it through and won't cause any ruptures or anything like that. A second knife I would recommend is a folding knife, because you know that if you do forget, for example, to cover your fixed blade knife, you know the folding knife automatically, you're going to fold it and you're not going to cause any damage to yourself or your gear, you know? Yeah. Oh, yeah, one more thing, a head torch. Never forget a head torch. That's really important.
They do.
Just in case.
They do come in handy. I've been stuck, you know, after dark. You shoot something last light, you know, working under a head torch to gut and skin and break down an animal, that's for sure. That's some great stuff. So what have you forgotten on a hunting trip?
Oh, me? My binoculars? A couple of times, actually. So I then either rely on my scope, which is very hard to glass around because you're on one section, or rely on my senses. So in the years, you start learning the sense of smell, the sense of vibration. You know, you start feeling, you use every sense in your body to detect any movement around you. And it's amazing the abilities as a hunter we have. And we start using those in our normal day-to-day lives. Those senses are just crazy amazing. It's really good. You start reading people as well. It's just really good.
Oh, I'm constantly scanning. Like, I drive a truck delivering plasterboard, and, you know, any hills trip I do, I'm driving down the road. I'm like, oh, there's a deer, there's this, there's that, there's this, you know. I went to Archery Park yesterday with Josh Haynes and Ilias Action Man, and walking along, and just out of the corner of my eye, I seen something a bit funny. And I've looked over, and it was three tawny frog mouths sitting on a branch, all nestled in together. I'm like, hey, Hainsey, look at that. And he's like, what? I'm like, there's some tawny frog mouths there. And because Hainsey's colorblind, so he can't pick up those real fine details. Yeah. And it was cool. Though, you know, 20 meters off the path, went and took some snaps. And he's like, I can't believe you spotted that.
They're really hard because they do blend in with the surroundings. It's amazing. They're like a bark colour.
They are. I was climbing a tree one time when I was younger, and went to grab this stump in the tree, and just grabbed a bunch of feathers. It wasn't a stump. I fell out of the tree, and that was my first intro to them.
Wow. That would have been a fright.
It was. I'm not sure if it was me or them that got the bigger fright. But with binos, are you running bino harness?
Yes, I do.
What bino harness are you running?
It's just like a wraparound in a way, not a vest, but it's just the straps that goes around, you know. And it was gifted to me by a really good friend, and they got it from Cabela's in America.
Yeah, beautiful.
Yeah, I love it. It's really good.
Yeah, I love them. I'll never hunt without a bino harness again. You know, you just carry everything, your knives, your binos, wind checker, lighter, bit of everything, snacks. Yeah.
my wind checker is, unfortunately, a cigarette. So bad. I know. But, yeah, it does work.
Yeah, well, that's what the old school hunters used to do. Yeah. They just use a cigarette. It
actually camouflages your smell as well.
And then
do not do it though. I don't recommend.
Next, you'll be telling me you get out there with a vape pen.
Oh no, not my thing. I tried, not during hunting, but I tried it for a while. It really hurt my lungs, and I was like, not doing that.
And then like the old school hunters said, you know, once they shot something, they'd sit down, light a smoke. Sit there, finish the smoke, and then go retrieve the animal because it gives it that time to just everything settles down and, you know, they just go peacefully without pushing them on, you know. So
you need to watch me one day while I'm skinning. I have a cigarette in my mouth and I'm sitting there skinning. It's like the, what do they call it? Celebratory cigarette. So you're celebrating, you know, the success, and you've got that cigarette when your hands are all dirty, and it's just, it's good.
I honestly can't imagine. So what's the most important thing you take out, apart from your pack of cigarettes, with your hunting?
A lot of anything that's got energy in it, so any fluids that got like a lot of hydrolyte, you know, like I, you know, take a lot of Powerade or Hunt Smart. I still do Hunt Smart here and there, especially in summer. If I am hunting in summer, I drink Hunt Smart. But I always have an extra Powerade in there just in case you don't know what happens. Unfortunately, I drink V as well, which is not good. Also, do not recommend.
I drink those Mother Energy drinks. They're horrible for you, but
they're bad. So don't drink it, people. But they're so delicious.
You and my wife would get along well, smashing the V's.
I love it. But a lot of fluids. It's really, really important. Yeah.
How many liters?
Important than food, I reckon.
How many litres of fluids are you taking out when you go out?
When I go out? So I'll have at least half a litre in my backpack. So two bottles of 250 mils or maybe 500 mil. But beforehand, I'll drink another like 250 mils. And yeah, just throughout the process, I don't drink quickly. I take sips. It's really important because you can hurt your insides as well. So when you're hot, your organs inside are contracting a lot. So when you start drinking something that's even at room temperature or cold, it can shock your system and you can have a lot of internal damage. So I do not recommend, you know, taking big gulps. Take little sips here and there. Keep hydrated. Try to avoid being under the sun, you know, under shade. It also gives you cover in the shade as well. But yeah, keep hydrated. It's really, really important. You know, I don't want to hear one day that one of the people I know are stuck in the bush, you know, dehydrated because they did not do the right thing, even though they drank a lot. Drinking a lot makes you want to go to the toilet quicker.
Yeah. What and about?
Forward. Yeah.
What's your thoughts on camel packs? Like a bladder in your.
They're good, but they do heat up quicker. I did do that for a while, but because of your back temperature, you know, the body heat, it heats up quicker and you start drinking really warm, warmer than warm water, which is not nice. But if you do end up, you know, holding those in your backpack, put some ice packs in there. You get those flat ice packs now these days. You can freeze those, the rolly ones. Put it with it towards your back. Make sure it's thick layer between the ice pack and your back, but that keeps it cool. There's a lot of methods where you can keep it nice and cool and enjoyable to drink, but I don't like it though.
Yeah, that's...
It tastes plastic a lot most of the times.
That's actually a pretty good idea. I reckon I'll have to try that over summer, chucking a cool pack in there. But I've got a pretty thick layer between my back and where the bladder sits. Plus, I have the bladder sitting in a smaller pack as well in the bag itself. So it keeps it, you know, somewhat at room temperature, not...
And again, there's like a lot of people that can't really afford that higher quality and that thickness, and they get those the cheaper, lightweight hiking packs.
Yeah.
Don't offer that kind of protection with keeping something cool, especially meat. So that's why, you know, it's always good to invest and get a good backpack.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
It does.
Speaking of backpacks, what type of pack do you run?
I used to work for BCF. I don't know, a lot of people used to know that. I bought a 50-litre Caribbee camo backpack, and I still use it till this day. I've tried other few backpacks, smaller, larger. Nothing was as comfortable with the support as the Caribbee. It was amazing and still is. The straps are heavy duty, never broke. I've had other backpacks where the straps broke midway of, you know, carrying back my meat, which was so uncomfortable and inconvenient. But yeah, it's got the body support, the chest support, you know, it's got the extra layers in the back where you can strap on things onto the back. It's really good.
Yeah, I've actually got two of them ones, so I know exactly what you're talking about, because I used to work at BCF as well, so I missed that discount, that's for sure.
Oh, same, believe me. They had good stuff.
They
especially
did.
With the fishing gear.
I missed that discount so much. BCF, come and sponsor the podcast so we can...
Yes, please do.
So... What's the most sketchy, dangerous thing that's happened to you out on a hunt?
Oh, yeah. So once my son and I, he was about 12, so we're jumping from – so it was like sort of like a cliff edge, so jumping from one ledge to the other, and I slipped and he grabbed me, 12-year-old, like nearly half my age. He grabbed me and saved me practically. Also, once I got lost in the bush, that was in the early stages of my hunting adventures, I was with a friend, and I did not know the rules back then. If they leave you in one spot, do not move. They will come back. Me, I did not know that, and they forgot to tell me this. So I started walking, looking for my friend. I got deeper and deeper into the bush. But then I remembered my dad, because he used to take us a lot hiking, a lot, nearly every week, just for fun in the Royal National Park. And he would show us where the deer were and teach us like about deer droppings and all that. So I remembered all the survival skills he taught us with, you know, the breathing, like smelling and, you know, recognizing, you know, a tree or a plant or anything like that. So I stopped. That's after 2 hours. I stopped. I remembered where the sun rose and where it was going to set, like it was about to. And I just started following where, you know, where the sun was moving, you know, going towards the direction, the opposite direction of the sun. So instead of following the sun, I went the opposite way. And it took me to a fence line. So I remembered that fence line. So I used to just walk the fence line until I saw a glimpse of the campsite. And I was like, I just broke down. I honestly broke down because I had no water. But during that time, I did not panic, because my dad always taught me, do not panic, because if you panic, you will, something will happen to you, you know. But I remembered how my dad taught us how to collect water, what to eat, how to forage, because we always foraged on our farm. So I was set on that side. I knew, like, with my clothing, I can collect water. I knew what to eat, what grasses I can eat. So I knew I will survive. But I needed that comfort and that safety of, you know, that tent and that blanket. Like, you know, I just wanted to get back. So when I saw that glimpse of it about maybe 300 meters away, really tiny, it felt like I was in the Sahara. But yeah, I knew how it felt like at that moment, like that relief. And I just fell to the ground. I kissed the ground. I'm like, put my hands in the air, and I'm like, thank God, like I'm home. It felt like home, but I wasn't home. But yeah, that was hard. And I learned my lesson. Do not move from your spot if someone leaves you. Stay in your spot. It's really important.
Yeah, I had a very, very similar circumstance happen when I was quite young, hunting with my pop. That's how I got into hunting with my grandpa. And we're out and actually took the compass reading too close to the car. And so the car, the metal from the car offsets the compass and put us completely in the wrong direction once we're heading back. So we're only going for an hour or two walk to go find some goats, and we ended up put off for a couple of hours. And, you know, being 8 or 9, you know, running out of water, and we didn't, because we were only gone for an hour or so, you know, running out of food and, you know, being younger, freaking out a little bit, and I've started going pale white. We end up finding the car. Everything was fine, but, you know, just Pop having a bit of sugar in the backpack gave that to me and, you know, helped me get through the rest of it. But, yeah, it definitely pays to, you know, carry water, carry extra water than what you need, carry some snacks, whether it's just a couple of lollies or a pack of mixed nuts or something in the bottom of your backpack, just in case.
Anything high in energy.
Definitely, definitely. So what's the funniest thing that's happened to you while you've been out hunting or fishing?
Oh, God. Other than slipping? Like one time I'm, like, looking in one direction and I'm, like, waiting. I had a long – I knew that I should have looked behind me because there was deer, and I did not because I was just sitting waiting. It was, like, part of – like, towards early stages of my hunting – time, and I went solo as well. So I was by myself, staring in one direction, thinking, I've seen them there. They're not going to be anywhere else. They're going to be there 100%. But all the time they were behind me. As soon as I turned around, they were gone. I'm like, what? I get laughed at about that. I've never told any, not many, I haven't told many people. Only a few of my friends know about it. They laugh about it. But yeah, it wasn't funny for me. I was so cut.
There's a video of a guy that just been like circulating around social media, and he's sitting there and he's live streaming and he's looking for deer and he's looking out in front of him, and you just see in the screen that the deer are walking in the paddock behind him, and he's like too busy talking, not paying attention, and the deer just walk off.
It happens. But now, like, I learned my lesson since then. I look all around. Don't make noise, but look all around. Cover every area that you're around. Yeah. Yeah, make sure.
Is a lot of your hunting spot and stalk, or are you sitting there waiting, or what?
Spot and stalk. A lot of it, yeah, a lot of walking involved. Like once I was hunting with Cody and my son as well, we were all together. We walked over 20K, way over 20K that day. By the end of the day, my hip was gone, completely gone. Like, I'm like, gosh, I'm getting old. I'm getting too old. I'm like, oh, my God, but no, I would never stop. I've told my kids, like, even if I'm really old and I can't move, you'll see me with my crutches or some kind of four-wheeled mechanism with a rifle on there, hunting in them hills.
Yeah, I've been telling my kids, and, you know, I'll be telling them in the future too. Once I can't hunt anymore, just drive me out into the forest and just let me go. Just, you're free, Dad. Just. So.
Yeah. I have sat a few times, but not much. I don't really sit much. Yeah.
It's hard. It's hard. And that's one thing that I struggled with at Snake Island recently, is just the sitting there waiting, because they tell you not to walk around. Just sit and wait and wait. You very rarely be successful if you're just wandering around. Yeah. So just.
They are very sensitive, those that species of deer.
They are. So you mentioned hunting with your son before. Hunting with your kids, how have you gotten them involved, and how have they taken getting involved?
Yeah, so my connection with my kids, like when I got divorced and I just let go of everything, anything that is lureable outside in the world, like a lot of women or men or whatever would go out clubbing, hang out with friends, and not a care in the world, even if they had kids. But no, I put all my focus into my kids, and every trip I took, I made sure they were with me and made sure they understood what I was doing and what was the meaning behind it and why we're doing that, whether it was fishing, you know, hunting, hiking. They got really interested in. So every week, because I used to go weekly a lot, every week I'll take one of my child, you know, each time I had a one-on-one with my kids, that brings them closer to me. We form a bond, more conversations, more understanding, deeper into the hunting world, because I was still learning as well, you know, so they learnt with me. But as my daughters got older, they became more into sporting shooters than hunters, which I do respect, because not everybody can hunt. But my son is in love with hunting. He loves it so much. Like, he's always with me. Most of my hunts, he's always with me. Yeah, he loves it.
That's great really to hear. Yeah. How old were they when they started going out with you?
So my oldest was about 13, 14. Oh, hang on. No. Sorry, I got that wrong. So she got her permits when she was 12. So she went out with me, yeah, around 13. Yes, that's, yeah, I was right. Yeah. And my youngest was about 6. Yeah, around that age. Yeah, so they understood everything, what was happening. You know, you can have a conversation with them. You can, you know, give and take with questions and answers. And it was interesting. It was really interesting seeing how they reacted to it, and how they, like myself and them being with me when I shot something, and how I would become really emotional. You know, I still get emotional. Because it's part of life. If we weren't emotional hunters, I think it would be scary.
Definitely.
We got to have that sense of love for nature and, you know, everything that's alive in this world. We need to care. If we didn't care, we won't hunt ethically.
Exactly.
Like myself and everyone that we know. They're all ethical hunters because they do care. Yeah.
And how would you recommend, like, people taking their kids hunting? Because, you know, I've chatted to some people and they're like, they're blown away that I take my youngest out with me, you know, and he's just about to turn 3. He's not even 3 yet, and he's done a few rabbit hunts with me, and you know, he's been coming out in the backpack checking trail cameras for the, you know, the last two ruts. He's come out with me checking trail cameras, and you know, I'll take a bow with me, not expecting to see anything. And like I mentioned earlier, you know, I took him out this morning with me, and it was my first actual hunt with him looking for deer. So what age would you recommend people start taking their kids out, and how would you introduce kids into it and dealing with like the death of an animal and then the blood and the gut side of stuff? And
so what I recommend, if you are you know, you just had a child, make sure they're at an age where it's safe to take them out, but as early as possible, because it's part of bringing them up, and then it becomes part of life as a norm. It won't be shocking. But when it's an older kid and you're introducing them to it, don't take them straight away. Show them videos online, you know, little things, you know, about hunting. Educate them with videos and nothing gruesome. Don't shock them. Don't put fear into them, because they're kids at the end of the day, and they associate animals with cartoons, with fairy tale. You know, you can't really scare them in that way. So little things, show them kids hunting. Even if they're 6 years old, six-year-old kids understand, you know, they're at a kindy age where they're in school already, they're learning, you know, they take it on board, it sticks with them, they won't forget that. So show them, you know, videos of families hunting, you know, introduce them that way, and then start taking them out hiking, showing them, you know, not hardcore hiking, but something that's simple, something fun. Put a picnic out there, show them this is amazing, this is part of who we are, this is the wildlife, we get to eat out here. Take meat with you, tell them this is what we're about to later on in the future. We're going to go out hunting, and this animal is going to give us meat. We're going to, you know, be healthy, and we're going to eat, and we're going to be thankful. It's like school. You know, you're not going to straight away give them something really hard and tough in school when they're young. You're going to start them off with something simple, soft, and kind to their age. And it's the same with anything in the outdoor.
Yeah, 100%. And what about teaching them to shoot? Did you start off teaching them with iron sights or scoped or?
Scopes.
Scope, yeah.
Scopes, yeah. You know, we're blessed to have those tools to use. So might as well use them.
Yeah. It's just one of the mentalities, old school mentalities, is, you know, start everyone off with iron sights, get them used to iron sights. And then
I did that with the air rifles, like, you know, something fun, cute, little, light, with no scope on it. And you do learn to aim, you know. I can't remember what rifle it was. I think a World War II rifle I shot, open sight. I think it was about 200 meters, and I got it bullseye.
That's awesome.
Yeah, bullseye. And, like, that was at Anzac Range in Sydney, the SSAA. And I was doing volunteering as a volunteer range officer. And I got the chance because one of the guys brought in their old school rifle, and I got to shoot it. And you can hear the guys on the walkie-talkie. I had the walkie-talkie on me, and the guys at the end, you know, monitoring the targets, they're like, whoa, who shot that? I'm like, I did. They're like, oh, watch out, Khadija's lethal. That was funny. That was really funny. But yeah, I know, you know, I can see why you would say that, because we did all shoot like that.
Yeah.
At first.
Yeah, we did. That's how I learnt, and that's, you know, you hear articles and podcasts. Lots of people recommend starting out with iron sights. So I just was curious to hear your take on it. And what about getting kids used to using a scope? Because, you know, when you put, you've had lots of experience getting new shooters on. You know, they hold the rifle all sorts of weird. You know, they're trying to look real close. How do you mitigate that, and how do you get them used to looking through a scope?
Yeah, so I'll give them advice. I'll tell them, okay, are you comfortable with the way you're holding your rifle, or if it's you know, on the bench with a bipod, or, you know, a sandbag or whatever we use. Once you're comfortable, okay, now look into the scope. Can you see? What are you seeing? How small is the circle? How big is the circle? move backwards and forwards until when you start seeing the ring disappear. I call it the ring. That means you're perfecting your sight. So once it completely disappears, that means now you can see clearly. And then you want to zoom in. I'll show them where you could zoom, because every scope's a bit different with the location of the zooming mechanisms, let's call it. So they start zooming in, and then also that plays around with the ring in the scope. So then I tell them, okay, you've zoomed, move backwards and forwards. See where it's comfortable. Make sure you're comfortable with your cheek on the stop, you know, the back stop. It takes a while with some people, and some people take it straight away, like they know what they're doing, as if they've done it before. But a lot of people do find it difficult at times, especially at the tri-shoots. So I go around most of the times. I don't actually sit with the ladies, because I used to, but now I actually do my rounds and make sure that all the ladies are comfortable with their range officer, give them tips and what to do with their breathing techniques, and, you know, use your body, your whole body, before you shoot. Make sure you're comfortable. Yeah. But, yeah.
That's some awesome advice. So what about top five dream animals? Like, money wasn't an issue. You could just travel to go anywhere. What would be your top five dream animals to go chase?
See, when I was younger, I used to say, maybe an elk or some kind of moose, you know. But when I got older, and a lot of people are going to hate me for this, I'm so sorry from now. But as I got older and I went into the conservation side of things in this country, let's say, I believe that every person that lives in a country needs to focus on their own country. Okay, I don't have top five animals.
Yep.
I have all animals are important, and all animals have a place in the world. And the non-native animals in Australia don't belong here. So I'm here running after those, let's say, five.
No, that's completely fine. We've had similar answers before, you know, and you see it quite a bit, you know. People only hunt because they're an introduced species in Australia. Like, why hunt something native? So I'd completely understand that, where you're coming from with that. So
I matured into the hunting world. My thoughts and, you know, my beliefs changed a lot, and I care for Australia so much to a point where I'm here and I'm going to do it here and only here, or New Zealand.
Yeah.
I consider New Zealand home as well, and they've had everything happen at the same timing, so we both have that same issue.
So when it, speaking of it like that, like if you could flick a magical switch tomorrow and wipe out every deer out of Australia, every goat, every pig, every, you know, introduced species at a drop of a hat, just completely gone, because we can't really shoot native animals, would you press that button?
Yes.
Yep.
Yep. Because the numbers in the native wildlife will grow, and we will still be able to source meat no matter what. No matter what. They'll actually grow, and we need to help them stay at a right number, because we don't want them to go extinct. Because if I did press that button and everything else did disappear, and then we left the native to fend for themselves, they will get extinct. It's the cycle of life.
Yeah, 100%.
So since the day dot humans hunted, whether it was native or non-native, there was no such thing back then.
Yeah, exactly. So
well, a lot of people go get educated, learn about it, because even though we're saying press a button and this is all gone, I know it's harsh, it sounds harsh, but from the get-go, animals existed, and then humans existed. They were they were a form of source of food for us. They'll still be around.
So with
the animals that were extinct are caused by other animals, not by us.
Yeah, exactly. So with the whole native animal thing, you know, at the moment, Victoria's facing issues with duck hunting seasons. South Australia's facing issues with duck hunting seasons. You know, there's always some type of protest about, you know, kangaroo shooting, all of that type of stuff. So if we could flick that switch and wipe out every introduced species, deer and all, then we only had native animals to hunt. How do you think the general public would cope, and do you think the governments would still try and ban it as much as they are?
Yeah, it will never change, unfortunately. That's the reality. We can't sit here and dream or think we're in La La Land saying, oh, one day it will happen. It's heartbreaking to say, and this is the real world. There's always going to be someone out there fighting us.
Yeah.
We need to stand hand in hand as hunters, no matter what, if you're a bow hunter, spear hunter, rifle hunter, in any form of hunting, we need to unite, not say, oh, you're a hunter with a gun, oh, you're not a hunter. We need to have one voice. We can't do that anymore. They're winning. We're letting them win by behaving that way. Especially with the duck hunting, there's heaps of ducks out there. There is. There's a lot. And coming from a person that loves eating birds, I love eating birds. It's a shame that we can't source as much as we want. You know, okay, there is a limit. All right. Okay, fine enough. That's fair enough. But don't put more on top of what we have at the moment. There's so much pressure. So much pressure. You're going to end up pushing people to do the wrong thing instead of doing the right thing.
So,
and time to be our sport at the end of the day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. With the number counts for that determine the duck seasons, do you feel that the biologists are giving us the correct numbers when it comes to that, or do you think there's fudging numbers involved? There's all speculation.
Yeah, there's always going to be numbers played around for their own benefit to grab more votes, because the majority of people in this country are not hunters. So they will say anything to attract people towards them to receive more votes. It's all about votes. It's all about me, me, me. It's all about money. They don't care if we killed an animal. It's not about that.
So as a biologist, they're supposed to be going into it as, you know, just a very centralized, you know, they're not doing it for the hunters. They're not doing it for the anti-hunters. They're there to put the facts out. This is how many ducks they are. This is how many we reckon there should be in a season, you know, because it's the effects of the season before are determining the next season. So whether, you know, the big floods, there's lots of speculation whether the numbers have been fudged. But speaking to someone such as Daniel Call from Eureka Tactical with his biologist background, you know, he thinks that, you know, not enough shooters and hunters are actually going. So all the available data's there, and there's ways to work out the actual number that you can, you know, harvest. Yeah. With numbers keep on growing after that, that we don't do our own research. We just play the victim card constantly. And since he's pointed it out, I see it a bit like that as well. You know, GMA have just released a bunch of studies done on lead in hunting dogs. And it's been funny just watching the comments. You know, everyone's got that victim mentality going in. Oh, you're just using this as a study to come after hunters when it's GMA doing the studies, you know. So it's a weird one. And since Dan's pointed it out, I do see us as being our own worst enemy at times.
Yeah. That's true. That is true.
So how do you see it on the political side of things? Like, because you've done some political stuff as well.
I have, and I've spoken and mixed with a lot of politicians. I won't say much, but there needs to be more honesty out there. There really needs to be more honesty out there. Don't feed, you know, especially if you're out there, you know, presenting yourself for us. Be honest. Don't sit there saying this is going to happen, this is going to happen, we're going to fight this, we're going to fight that, and then it doesn't end up happening. You know, it can go, I'm not talking about a specific group or anything, I'm talking in general. You know, even when I went up for voting, standing with, you know, the opposition's right next to me while we were at the, you know, place where people voted, the voting stations. I had one guy come up to me saying, "Are you for building or against building on our land here?" I said, "I'm against." He said, "Why?" I go, "Because we're now sourcing our produce from overseas and we're losing a lot of land, healthy land that are capable of growing fruits and vegetables, to houses, which is so unfair. And a lot of our farmers are ending up packing up and selling and moving because they can't afford the land rates anymore and they can't afford the business. You're just pushing people away." He's like, "Oh, I'm not voting for you." I go, "Why not? Are you from the city or something?" He's like, "Yeah, but I came here. I want to bring more of my family and we need more houses." I go, "It's okay. I don't need your vote. That's fine." But when he moved away, one of the oppositions, which was a female, comes up to me because she heard the whole conversation. She's like, "Why didn't you just say yes? You're for it. You could have got a vote." I go, "No, because I'm an honest person. I'm going to be honest, and I've promised I'm going to be honest, and I'm not going to trick anyone into anything just for a vote. A vote means nothing to me if I'm not honest."
Yeah. No, we definitely need more politicians need like that, that's for sure.
Be honest, please. With everybody, not just us, with everyone. With everyone. Don't take sides. Just treat everybody equally.
So with people stepping up to the political side of things, how do you recommend someone getting involved with, say, Shooters Fishers Farmers Party on behalf of hunters? How would someone, if you know they're like, "I've had enough of how things are going, the SA bow ban, proposed bow hunting ban, the duck season, all of that stuff," how does someone get involved and, you know, start putting their voice up on the political side of things?
So do a lot of community work, mix with people, start talking, having conversations about what we do or what's out there and what's available, create pamphlets, you know, things like that with information on there, or, you know, links to where they can source out more information. But being publicly present in your community where you live, helping, like I did a lot of drop-offs with native plants to schools. I didn't post about it, but I did a lot of work in that way, in conservation and how important it is to protect our native wildlife and vegetation and what damages non-native wildlife are doing. Coming with that kind of education instead of straight away talking about killing an animal is really important, and it brings people in and they start understanding why, once you start telling them, you know, more and more about what you do. So, yeah, as a politician or stepping into that political world, become involved with your community and get them to understand who you are and why you do it and why you support what you do and the people that are involved in that sport as well. Yeah.
No.
And be honest. Please.
Exactly.
It's really important.
Yeah, we definitely need more people stepping up on the political side of things to, you know, get our community's way of life out there for more people to understand without getting, because these animal rights parties and all of that seem to be getting more and more traction.
And but you know what's funny? They actually know we're right.
Doesn't surprise me.
They said, "No, we're right. We're actually protecting our country. We're keeping everything at a level where it's healthy." You know, if they stopped us, everything's going to drop.
Yeah, I just think there's a lot of ignorance there that they don't.
Without me pushing a button, they're doing the button. They're pushing the button, honestly.
Yeah. So moving away from the political side of things, what's your favourite thing to cook with hunted food?
Oh, okay, goat meat. And my favourite, which is a traditional country dish that is sourced from North Lebanon countryside, because my heritage are farming. Like, they're all farmers, all my family. They own acreage. And so they used to, when they hunted, they'll bring, you know, the freshest meat, which, and use the backstrap a lot, or the shoulders. So we'll dice it up and we'll cut up some lots of onions, saute the onions, brown the meat with salt and pepper, add the onions, you know, brown it a bit more, then add some pomegranate molasses into it, stir it a bit, plate it up, eat it with Lebanese bread and a wedge of lemon. The best.
It sounds good.
You need to try it.
It sounds really
cooker. You don't have to age the meat or nothing. Yeah. No. And lightly brown the meat. It's really nice.
That definitely does sound good. I'll have to get you to send me the details on how to do that. Or I'll just listen back to the episode and work it out.
You can do it while you're camping as well. It's the easiest thing to cook.
Awesome.
In a pan.
Mm. I'll definitely have to keep that one in mind. So what's your best hunting story?
Oh, I've had a few, but lately I don't think I have a best. I've taken everything that was best out of every trip I've had, you know, and I don't know. I can't really pinpoint one, to be honest.
No, that's understandable.
Wait, hang on. Yes. Oh, the first deer that we took down on my property. Now that is something special. That is special. It's not like the big story, but it's something really, really special to me. Because see how we say, oh, we got a new truck. Oh, let's take it out bush and christen it. I actually felt like I christened my property by taking a deer. Mind you, I shot so much stuff on their pigs and goats and foxes, but never a deer. And I always tried my best not to really cause a lot of noise in my area so I can bring them in, so I can shoot them. But, yeah, my son actually spotted it.
That's awesome.
That was like, I'm out there at the game camp trying to change the SD card and, you know, putting some, you know, feed out there and stuff because I've got the cows around. And then he's like, Mom. I'm like, what? It's like, get down. I'm like, what's happening? He's like, I see a deer. I'm like, what? What? Middle of the day towards, so like we're coming into the middle of the day, the hottest time of the day as well. So it was the end of spring, early summer. I can't remember exactly when, but around that timing this year, December. It happened in December. Yeah. And, he goes, it's just right there. So I, you know, got the rifle ready, went on all fours, you know, crawling, and he stood there, you know, waiting for me. We actually didn't think we were going to hunt anything. We went up there just to get everything prepared, and I didn't bring his earmuffs, you know, the ear protection, because I like to make sure my kids are protected, you know. For me, I should, but I neglect myself a lot sometimes, which I don't recommend. Do not do it. Protect your ears. But yeah, I went on, you know, I laid on my belly and took aim and shot it within 20 meters. It was down. It dropped. It did not move.
And what deer species was that? Fallow?
Fallow, yeah.
Beautiful.
Fallow. Young fallow buck. young one.
Yeah, those spikes tend to move at all different weird times.
True.
So how do you see the public views on hunting and hunters?
Oh, they see us as barbaric, to be honest. Like we're not normal, we're like evil. But I believe education is really important. Even if you feel like you're getting attacked with words, don't retaliate. Be as calm as possible as you can. I am the most calmest person you'll ever come across. And a lot of people have noticed that online, that I don't retaliate or come back with a comment, that I don't let it get to me. I start coming back with a nice answer, an educated answer, and they'll still keep coming back with, you know, something even heavier with what they were on about. And I keep educating and educating with a lot of people like that. I've become friends, actually. They become, you know, more educated, more understanding, and as to why we're doing it. And a lot of them won't do it. They won't pursue that, but they have formed a respect towards who we are as hunters. But there's also, unfortunately, a lot of closed-minded people, which I don't blame sometimes because of their upbringing. And it's been, stamped on them. That's it. there's a lot of stubborn personalities out there. And like, they might see us like that as well. That's how I see it. So I can't really judge.
Yeah.
Because I'm getting judged as well at the same time. So they're going to think like, we're barbaric. We're not normal. We're, you know, evil. We're killers. We're murderers.
Yeah.
And I, and grass eaters, oh, they don't care. Oh, bloody hippies, blah, blah. You know what I mean? Like, mind you, I love hippies. I have nothing against hippies. I love you all. All right.
It's okay. I don't think they'll be listening to the podcast.
Oh, no, I have a few neighbours down where my property is. They're full-on hippies, but hunters.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So a lot of the worlds have mixed, you know, with education. They have mixed. A lot of crossover,
yeah.
Which is really, really good to see. Yeah.
So how would you change the public views on hunting and hunters?
Okay. Don't post on your social media or anything that's got to do with the social, you know, platform, anything gruesome on there. Especially, I know I might receive a lot of hate with that one, what I'm about to say again. But with, you know, pigging, please don't post that. Okay, each to their own. If you are interested in doing it or you do do it, please don't post about it. Show the end result. But don't show the whole process, because it is putting a bad mark on us.
Yeah.
Because, we talk about not putting the animals through suffering and pain and agony, and we need to ethically kill it straight away without it knowing that it is about to get killed. And that portrays a completely opposite meaning behind hunting. It becomes more an enjoyment, more a satisfaction towards the person instead of what it is about, removing non-native species.
Yeah.
So don't post about things like that, or you can post about, you know, while you're butchering, that's fine. That's showing people that you are going to use and utilize that animal. You are going to eat it. But, yeah, anything that's really gruesome where the head is chopped off and you're holding a head or doing silly things like that, don't do it. Don't do it. We need to show ourselves as respectful as possible. Don't do anything silly. We need to portray ourselves as good hunters, good people.
So with some of that, just quickly, like, do you feel that the people that want us to stop hunting through seeing the stuff on social media and all of that stuff, do you feel that if they see a respectful photo of a dead animal, they're going to be just as upset as if someone's holding up a, you know, a caped out head, or they're... there's someone's sticking a pig. Like, it doesn't matter what
we put out there, it's
going to upset them no matter what. There's no scale for them going, oh, this person's doing this, but this person's got a respectful photo.
Yeah, no, completely opposite. Like, what I meant by is just try to minimalize the gruesome stuff behind it.
Yeah.
Don't stop posting your animal. Don't stop showing all that. But just minimalize what you put out there, like with the bad side of things, you know, like showing too much blood, or, you know, it's going to push people away instead of bringing them back in.
Yeah.
We are our main enemy. We are causing that to ourselves sometimes because of what we put out there. You know, we need to be careful. We need to protect our sport. We need to protect our lifestyle. We need to protect the way of life. We need to protect the way we source our food. By how we behave and by what we put out there and portray, hunters.
Yeah.
Very.
Yeah, 100%. I just see it as, like, you know, the people, they don't like the anti side, like the stuff that you're talking about will affect the people on the fence, whether they're in or out for hunting, but exactly. The people that are fully against it, no matter how respectful the photo is, they're going to see it as gruesome as someone on the fence seeing a pig getting stuck, or, you know.
But then again, the ones that are really hard to educate were brought up that way. It's exactly the same how I was saying before, with a child you want to introduce to hunting. Yeah. That becomes a way of life, and it's the same with them. So we see them that way and they see us that way. There's no way that's going to change, unfortunately.
And unfortunately, you know, some of these people getting into politics, as Susan Close, South Australia, the proposed bow hunting ban, the ducks. From my understanding, she's come out of a very anti-hunting environment. She's grown up in that anti-hunting environment. So now that's pushing over into politics.
Yeah. So,
yeah, it's a hard one, that's for sure. You know, when that, you know, there's...
She might be an amazing person, but her I don't know, her beliefs in a few things is completely wrong.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, there is some great organisations and that have hunting-only social media. I've got a couple of them on here. There's Go Wild, which is a completely hunting outdoor social media. And then there's also the Hunting Club. They have a website once you become a member called The Campfire. And all hunters that are part of the Hunting Club, and you get access to their own social media. And I know that there's some great stuff going there in the background as well. So for people to check that out. I'm not sure if you've had too much to do with it. I know Cody actually won a voucher for when he shot his chittle. Voucher for that. So they do some amazing stuff. But the social media side of it is good because it doesn't have those people, even though it's good to have those people on the outside for some of the stuff. But yeah, it's a tricky one when it comes to all of that stuff. But moving on to a happier note, what is hunting to you?
Hunting means everything to me, especially being a single parent. That was a way to source food for my children in the start, but it became deeper, more valuable, especially, as I said earlier, becoming a conservationist. I truly believe that it is so important that I would actually fight till my last breath for our sport and way of life. It's that important to me, so I can't really label it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's...
It runs through my veins. So the way I behave and the way I portray hunting is showing how much I love it and respect it.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. And I feel most of us feel very, very similar. And I say at the end of every episode, it's one of my favorite questions on the podcast, because no matter how the person says how they feel about it, I can relate. So that we've come to the end of the podcast. If people have enjoyed what they've heard, they want to support you, they want to check out the amazing stuff you do, but over, you know, the shooting, the women's shooting club stuff, the, you know, your conservation stuff, your political stuff, like your acting stuff, you got your hands in every cookie jar. Where can they go find it all? Where can they follow you? Where can they support you?
So if you only just type in Khadijah or CADZ, which is KADZ Huntress on Google, you'll find everything about me on there. All the links to all my social platforms. A lot of links to articles that I've been on, podcasts, news articles. Just search for me on Google. You'll find me on there, 100%. I believe someone's did a Wikipedia page on me as well, somewhere out there, I'm not sure.
That could be dangerous, those Wikipedia pages always are. But I just want to say thank you for coming on, but also thank you for all the amazing work that you do for the hunting and shooting community, and you're bringing lots of people into it, you know, like we discussed earlier. Lana, she's come out and done one of your shooting days, and you've got plans to take her out hunting soon, which is amazing. I can't wait to see. You just do an amazing job for the whole hunting community, and I've never heard someone say a bad word about you. Everyone that I know that knows you thinks you're just an outstanding and amazing person.
I'm so grateful. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
No, thank you very much. Have a great night.
You too. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Hunting Connection Podcast. Please head over to our social media and give us a follow. Instagram at Hunting Connection Podcast, Facebook at Hunting Connection Podcast, Twitter at Hunting Connect, TikTok at Hunting Connection Podcast. If you've enjoyed, please share with your friends and family, tag us in your photos and videos on social media, subscribe, rate and review to help grow the podcast. If you're interested in giving additional support to the podcast, you can head over to our podcast's Patreon page. Thank you very much for listening and catch you next episode.